Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Think about this for just one brief second, would you? The market value of the biggest publicly traded company on the planet rose, then fell, and rose, and then fell some more. A swing of more than 5% just because of some things a guy was saying on a stage someplace in Northern California. How about that? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 9th of September, Tuesday. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. Share price volatility aside, and I should mention here that Apple shares closed in the red for the day, down 37 cents. But all of those up and down swings today aside, they came as Apple CEO Tim Cook was basically just confirming all the rumors. It's an iPhone 6 and an iPhone 6 Plus, both of them bigger than the current varietals. Also, an Apple Watch. But that's not all, you know. Never is with Apple. Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech, is, as it happens, in San Francisco today. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kai.
So what are the experts there saying? I mean, you're in the white-hot center of the technology universe, man.
Well, I would say that the experts are saying, they're interested. I've been here at TechCrunch's Disrupt. I'm going to be here all week covering this conference and talking to people. I actually got into a cab this morning, and the driver was like, hey, no traffic downtown today because everybody's down in Cupertino. So as far as the trained professionals, you know, the best evidence I've had of what they think is that most of them sort of left my event this week and headed down to the Apple event in Cupertino to check out the watch.
Yeah, which I think says something. Yeah, so this watch. I mean, you got the iPhone 6 and the iPhone 6 Plus, and that's great. The whiz-bang new piece of hardware is this watch. Give me your gut.
You know, Tim Cook said while announcing this watch, the Apple Watch, as it's called, that the company is, quote, set out to make the best watch in the world.
Wow.
Well, I give it a rating of meh, Kai. Yeah. It is sleek in that Apple way. You can tap it and touch the screen to do stuff. It also has these sensors on the back that monitor your location, tells you your heart rate in real time.
Oh, good.
Yeah, good, exactly. Lets you communicate with animated emoji. It, you know, charges wirelessly.
All right.
I don't know. I feel like a lot of people are saying, I'll probably get one if I'm an Apple fan, but I don't have to get one. It's not a game changer.
Game changer, it does seem to me, out of this thing was this new payment system they've got, Apple Pay. Tell me about that.
Okay, so this to me is actually more interesting. The service is called Apple Pay. The company partnered with American Express, MasterCard, Visa. It's exclusive, by the way, to the Apple Watch or the iPhone 6.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the iPhone 6 has a special chip in it. The chip encrypts information, lets you add payment cards so that you can use it at merchants. You basically show up and press the button with your finger to use that Touch ID thing, looks at your finger, and boom, you can pay for stuff. The interesting thing here to me is that Apple Pay uses this kind of tokenization technology that we've been hearing so much about.
Which is, we should say, in light of all these, you know, hacks and thefts of card data, it's a security thing.
Yes, exactly. So merchants never actually get your card information. They just get a code from your phone that can't easily be used by hackers, for instance. All this could be a really big deal because Apple has 800 million credit cards, by the way, on file. And so they have a big potential user base.
Right. Really quickly before I let you go, Ben, can you now say, I mean, the third anniversary of Steve Jobs' death is this this coming month, October. Is this now Tim Cook's company and not Steve Jobs' company anymore?
I don't know. It's hard to say, Kai. I don't know that it fits the kind of vision we were used to from Jobs. What I think is interesting here is that Tim Cook is focused on the software as much or more than new iterations of hardware. And that actually, I think, reflects Cook's vision. It also reflects the fact that consumers aren't yet sold, for instance, on wearable technology. The you know, Apple Watch might change that, but I'm not sure it'll have as much of an impact as mobile payments could, for instance. And that could be actually the real difference between Steve Jobs' Apple and Tim Cook's Apple.
Ben Johnson, he is the host of Marketplace Tech. We got him in San Francisco this week. Ben, thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Kai.
We were talking about credit card security. Ben and I were... Well, hello, Home Depot. The company has confirmed a massive hack of its customer information database, bigger quite possibly than Target just a couple of months ago. Why is it that retailers get hit so often? Because, as the saying goes, that's where the money is. So what are those companies doing to fight back? Here's Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein.
Remember back in the day when online shopping gave people the jitters? Those days, says Matthew Prince of Cloudflare, are over.
I feel more safe inputting my credit card into an online form now than I do handing it to a waiter at a restaurant.
Here's what many of us don't understand. You know the cash register, or what some call the point of sale device, where we swipe our credit card? That's actually a computer. And in this Home Depot attack affecting millions of customers and other similar attacks, hackers are breaking into that software system and stealing our credit and debit card information. Lillian Ablon with RAND says right now the attackers are at least one step in front of the merchants.
We're in the golden age of cyber, where there's still a lot of holes, there's still a lot of gaps.
One of the gaping gaps, our sale information is easy to grab when it enters the computer. Forrester research analyst John Kindervog says encryption is a simple fix.
That technology actually exists off the shelf. It just has to be purchased.
The magic word, purchased.
Retail is a low-margin, cheap business, so anytime they have to spend money, they don't want to do it.
In many cases, stores would need to upgrade hardware and software. For the largest companies, we're talking millions of dollars in equipment. The other problem, Kindervog says encrypting this data could stifle other lines of retailers' business.
It will potentially mean that they have to do business intelligence and marketing intelligence in completely different ways. And that will be a disruption of their decades-old business model.
Kindervog predicts retailers would shape up if consumers started shopping with competitors who take data breaches seriously. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Wall Street today slightly worse than meh, I would say. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You are what? A morning person? A night owl? Middle of the day type, perhaps? I'm a morning guy, no question about it. Everybody's got that zone where they function best. A new study out of Georgetown University says your chronotype, that's the sciencey word for what time of day you are at your peak, can affect your decision-making at work, and not just whether to make another run for coffee or not. We're talking the big stuff here. Sally Herships has more.
Sometimes it can be hard to do the right thing, the ethical thing, especially if you're tired.
I've gone to people and I tell them, look, listen, I am too tired to deal with it right now. You need to leave or something bad's going to happen to you.
Chuck Collins is 38. He's not violent.
What's up, y'all? How you feeling? All right.
He's a bouncer and a comic book artist. It's 11:30 at night and we're standing outside the bar where he works in Soho. And then we should describe, you are not a small petite gentleman. But Colin says his muscles are mostly around just for backup.
This job is 99.9% psychological. You do get periods of time where people, they cannot be reasoned with. And you have to be able to be that guy.
The guy who, even if he's built like Collins and is mentally exhausted from dealing with overly friendly regulars, can still decide to do the right thing instead of the easy thing, which can be tough.
We know that ethical decisions are taxing.
Sunita Saw teaches business ethics at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business.
So we have limited cognitive resources and less self-control at certain times of the day.
She says our ability to be ethical and to do ethical work lines up squarely with our chronotype, our sense of morning or late-night personness.
And this is important because it means that people can be ethical at one point in time and unethical at another point in time.
The same person, which calls the very fabric of the workday schedule, as we know it, into question. Morning people, says Saw, have an easier time being ethical in the morning. Night owls, you should be filling out expense reports and giving out advice to clients later in the day. Saw says employers should keep this in mind when they're making schedules.
What time of day did you work on the results of your paper?
Well, we looked at our results at several times during the day.
Not on purpose, I saw, but because that's when it felt good. Our body clocks have a huge effect on the way we work as well as its quality.
To take a simple example, if you pull an all-nighter as a college student, some people the next morning are literally blithering idiots.
Dr. David Rappaport is director of the Sleep Medicine Center at NYU's Langone Medical Center. A lot of his patients don't have sleep disorders. They're shift workers. They work nights or other odd hours and have trouble adapting.
And so shift work is essentially temporary jet lag. And that's why people don't feel well or are unable to do it, or in the case of this ethics discussion, have a great deal of difficulty at one time, but less so at another.
Rappaport says some people deal with being out of sync with nature's clock better than others. According to Circadian, a consulting firm for companies which work 24/7, employees who cover the night shift cost an extra $10,000 a year. Each. They have more accidents, higher healthcare costs, and turnover rates. But there can also be a benefit to working against your body clock, which is what Marijke Veit and I did recently.
Whose idea was this? I don't know. I think it was yours.
Oh my God. Veit is a psychology professor at Albion College in Michigan. It's 10 o'clock at night, which might not sound late, but both of us have been up since about 6 a.m. and we're both morning people. So we got a little zany.
Like right now, I feel like a cat, like when you dangle string in front of it and the cat is like, string.
Yep. But Veit says that's the point. She says, imagine if you get a bunch of night owls at a breakfast meeting.
They're going to be much more distracted. They're going to be much more, you know, they might check their devices a bunch and they may doodle a lot more and think about the conversation they had last night, which may lead to something really creative.
Veit says it depends on what you want the outcome of your work to be. Dr. Rappaport says medicine and technology can help some workers sleep better, but if your biology doesn't let you do shift work, the best treatment is not to do it. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up, realizing that it is rocket science, despite having a couple of hundred of the best engineers in the world working on it, it's been incredibly tough.
Richard Branson on space travel and more. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 97 points today, more than a half percent, closed at 17,013. The NASDAQ lost 40 points, 0.8%, finished at 45.52. The S&P 500 down 13 points, 0.2%, ended things at 1988. Apple, we did already, so shares in Home Depot knocked off 2% after the retailer confirmed its payment systems were breached, as we mentioned. The new United Nations report says concentrations of greenhouse gases hit a record high last year. Shares in some energy companies took a hit. Arch Coal was down 4.5%. Console Energy off more than 1% today. In corporate news, General Mills said it's buying the organic and natural food company Annie's. General Mills shares off 0.6%, but Annie's shot up 37%. The pasta, by the way, in Annie's mac and cheese is shaped like little rabbits, which helps explain the company's ticker symbol, BNNY, bunny. Get it? I love capitalism. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and sales for July. The Senate Special Committee on Aging holds a hearing titled Indebted for Life, Older Americans and Student Loan Debt. And for your convenience and to accompany your favorite primetime program, tomorrow is National TV Dinner Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know how pretty much everybody says you gotta have a college degree to get ahead in today's economy? Turns out that's true, and not just to get ahead. Either you need a college degree almost to just keep pace. It's a phenomenon known as credential creep. And a study out today from a labor market analysis firm called Burning Glass Technologies confirms the phenomenon is alive and well in America. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott has more.
Executive assistant, registered nurse, construction supervisor, Burning Glass Technologies looked at millions of online job postings. A lot of those that used to require a high school diploma or maybe a certificate now demand a four-year college degree. CEO Matt Siegelman says some of those jobs, like nursing or drafting, are more complex than they used to be.
At the same time, we also saw lots and lots of jobs where the jobs haven't changed, where the jobs that ask for a college degree and those that don't look any different from one another.
For example, about half of IT help desk jobs now require a bachelor's degree, even though the demands of the job are the same in positions that don't ask for a degree. 65% of listings for executive assistants require a BA, but only 19% of people in those jobs now have one. Siegelman says a degree has become a convenient way for employers to sort through hundreds of applicants.
The problem there is that doesn't necessarily correspond with what makes people successful in the job.
And it's made it harder for the two-thirds of American workers without college degrees to find work that pays well. For people with degrees, though, employers are willing to pay more. Economist Tony Carnevale directs Georgetown University's Center on Education and the Workforce.
You might think that employers are just hiring degrees because they're there and they can get them cheap. But what the data also shows is that they're paying for the degrees.
Siegelman with Burning Glass says even for those with degrees, there's a downside.
The bad news is that a lot of that demand is for jobs that you probably didn't go to college to do.
That may be especially tough to face if you took on a lot of college debt to get that job. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Commerce Department says we bought more than $260 billion worth of stuff online last year. That's the whole smash. Books, movies, power tools, cars, widgets, dog food, everything. But, and this is a pretty big caveat here, how much do you really trust internet retail? I mean, you don't like a piece of furniture or something, you just send it back. What do you do, though, for the important stuff, the stuff that memories are made of? Shannon Mullen takes a look at that.
Dan Stover and his wife Megan got married a year ago this month.
All right, so this is our wedding album. Timing is good. We just got it a couple weeks ago.
And this is the guys getting ready.
In the photos, the groom and his groomsmen are wearing seersucker bow ties, yellow boutonnieres, and slim gray suits.
You know, you can see it's quality fabric. It's not like it's, you know, polyester or something. And
the suits were rentals, but not from a strip mall chain store. They came in the mail a week before the wedding from theblacktux.com.
First thing I did was rip that thing open, and I tried it on because I wanted to see if this was a total disaster or if this was a home run. And the fit was perfect. For our wedding, maybe it was a little bit of a leap of faith.
The Black Tux is a web-only retailer, so Stover couldn't try a suit on in advance. But the site lets you enter your body type and all your measurements. Stover says the company had good customer reviews. And as a busy medical fellow, he was used to buying clothes online to save time. Another plus, he saved his five best friends a lot of money.
It was like 100 and change. That's less than renting a standard tux, and far less than buying a suit.
Without the cost of running retail stores, web-only companies can invest more in their products and sell them for less. The Black Tux launched last year and just wrapped its first full wedding season. Co-founder Andrew Blackman says inventory was fully booked up to 2 months in advance.
Yeah, I think absolutely that signals a huge consumer shift. If people are able to trust us with the tuxedo rentals for, you know, arguably the most important day of their lives, I think that shows that people are adopting e-commerce at a level that they probably weren't in the last 5 years.
If you leave out Amazon, the top 200 web-only retailers racked up almost $38 billion in sales last year, according to InternetRetailer.com. That's up 22% from the year before.
There's another trend that's underlying this as well, which is our willingness and maybe even preference to rent things rather than buying them outright.
David Bell teaches marketing and e-commerce at the University of Pennsylvania. His case in point, renttherunway.com, launched for women in 2009, featuring designer dresses for as little as $30. The company now has more than 5 million members and just added a monthly rental program, like Netflix for clothes.
Firms have got better about giving us pre-information through better technology, better pictures, free returns, and so on. So I think we've gradually been trained into buying almost anything online.
A new report from Business Insider shows 18 to 34-year-olds still spend more money online than any other age group. And in that demographic, 40% of guys and a third of women say ideally they'd buy everything online. Dan Stover says he'd recommend renting a wedding suit from the web to almost anyone. And his wife, Megan?
I was okay with it.
How do you think he looked?
I think he looked quite handsome. I mean, I thought the suits looked amazing.
But as for her wedding dress, she felt more comfortable getting it the old-fashioned way, from a store. In Boston, I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
Richard Branson is no stranger to the spotlight. He has made a career of and built an enormous conglomerate from keeping himself and his brand front and center. Virgin is, of course, the brand. Airlines, music, space travel, and 300 or more other companies as well. He has put down his thoughts on how to run such an enterprise in a new book. It's called, not surprisingly, The Virgin Way. Mr. Branson, good to have you with us.
It's always good to be with you. Thank you.
I confess I was surprised, as I was reading up for this interview, to find out that you don't actually sit on the boards of directors of any of the companies inside the Virgin Group, which makes me ask this question. Are number one, why? And number two, are you a businessman or are you just a straight-up entrepreneur?
I've never thought of myself as a businessman. I've always thought of myself as somebody that loves to create things and hopefully make a positive difference to people's lives, and hopefully the bills will there'll be more money coming in than going out at the end of the year. And so from a very young age, I decided I did not want to be a director of any of the Virgin companies. I wanted other people to do the the business aspect so that I could be freed up to be a bit more of a creator.
As you think about the Virgin Group and all that you've done since that first magazine, I guess you published when you were, what, 18-something years old, you are now in music and healthcare and airlines and banking. I mean, lifestyle, you name it, you're in it. What has been the toughest nut to crack? What's the toughest business decision that you had to get into?
Well, building a rocket to take us into space, realizing that it is rocket science, despite having a couple of hundred of the best engineers in the world working on it, it's been incredibly tough. And it's only about 2 months ago, we were actually building simultaneously two separate rockets that they both came good at the same time. But it's taken us some years longer than we'd expected. And all I can say is that when we go into the space in the next few months, it'll be something which we'll definitely be celebrating. And it was tougher than we'd expected.
Do you ever chit-chat with Elon Musk? I mean, you guys are in different parts of space, right? He's in the, payload delivery and getting people up to orbit. You're in more the tourism space. But do you guys ever chit-chat about how tough this is? And, man, if you had it to do over again, maybe you wouldn't?
We're both friends. In fact, we're about to share a home next to each other on an island in the Virgin Islands. So we're close friends. And We're going to be, yeah, putting, as you say, putting people into space. He's put payloads into space. So we're in a slightly different area. But yeah, but it's been tough for both of us. If it was easy, there'd be lots of private spaceship companies. We really are the only two out there. You know, I think we're both going to pull it off. Virgin Galactic have built it, our spaceships in the shape of an aeroplane, so that one day we can start transporting people at great speeds around the Earth, point to point. So a lot of exciting things in the future.
You are, 63 years old, right?
64, I think. 64. No, maybe. Right. Oh, actually, hopefully 63. Hopefully you're right.
Question, though, is you are not going to be around forever. You may at some point decide to stop doing this before you're not around forever anymore. What happens to this company without you?
You know, I've spent a lifetime sort of building the Virgin brand, and I think the brand is now, you know, one of the better known brands in the world, mm-hmm. and it's well respected, and therefore I think can live on after me. I mean, I'm fortunate. I have two great kids, Holly and Sam. So there is a sort of succession, a family succession plan in place. They're both very creative themselves. They're both adventurous. And I think they can continue to be the face of Virgin once I've stepped down. But we also just have a fantastic team of people who run Virgin. One of the advantages of learning the art of delegation early on is Virgin runs really well.
Richard Branson of the Virgin Group. Mr. Branson, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Pleasure. Thank you. Cheers.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, a little bit serious, a little bit silly. From CNN Money, this item: more people own cats right now in this economy than own individual stocks. That is, not counting mutual funds and all of that. There are some new numbers out from the Federal Reserve showing just under 14% of Americans own individual stocks right now. That is down from a high of 18% before the recession. Meanwhile, according to the American Veterinary Medical Association, 30% of households in this country own at least one cat. Not mine, though. I'm a dog person. I had cats when I was a kid. I don't know. Maybe that saves me. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace. The Dow off 97 points, more than 0.5%. The NASDAQ off 40 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 down 13 points, 0.2%. Our special projects team is Nancy Fargali and Millie Jefferson. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Ash are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin, Shea Huffman, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are here again tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.